Stint in this program, must have been over 20 years ago, we did the most harrowing story on what was then called the Belgian Congo. Belgium, not because it was a simple colony of Belgium, but because it was owned personally by its despicable king, who, in the process of ripping rubber out of the place, caused the death of millions of Congolese. Well, we keep going back to the Congo, and it never seems to get much better for them. In recent years, we've been talking about what's called Africa's First World War, because this is the country where terrifying stories of child soldiers compete with even more terrifying stories of warlords, including one Joseph Kony, leader of the Lord's Resistant Army, which we've talked about on other occasions. In 2003, a transitional government was put in place and the war was declared over. Three cheers, but of course it's never that simple. Last December, Kony's troops carried out a series of massacres and abductions in the northeastern part of the country, leaving hundreds dead and hundreds missing, presumably abducted. This is a carnage by anyone's standard, and yet there was little, if any, media reports, and I can't recall any follow-up. Now, for my next guest, this is sadly an everyday occurrence. Anneke van Woudenberg is a researcher with Human Rights Watch in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it's a job which requires her to talk to both victims of extreme violence and to those who inflict it. And she's here in Australia for a conference on civilian protection and joins me tonight from Melbourne. Welcome to our Little Wireless program.
Thank you very much.
Now, what makes you all the more remarkable is that you didn't begin your life as a human rights researcher. You were involved, well, in an almost comparably dramatic life as an investment banker.
Yes, well, indeed, it did all start out initially in the private sector. And, you know, like many individuals, I think when I finished university, I, of course, had a large student loan that I needed to pay off. And so after I finished my master's degree, I indeed joined the private sector and was an investment banker for many years before I switched over to doing humanitarian and human rights work.
I understand there was that magical night when you were moaning about your job and a friend dared you to do something more meaningful.
That's right, yes. And I think that's probably also a common occurrence when you work in banking. Indeed, one night in a pub in London, I was complaining about a job I wasn't getting much satisfaction from, and a friend said to me, you know, stop moaning, and waved an application form in my face, which was for a job in the Congo. And after far too many drinks, said, I dare you to apply, and I did, and it changed my life.
So you started working with Oxfam in around 1999. That was pretty much at the beginning of the war.
Yes, so when I first arrived in Kinshasa, the capital of Congo, this was a city under siege, so to speak. There was a nightly curfew. The war had just begun a few months earlier. You know, it was a place very much where people thought the rebel group was going to attack any time. And I really lived through that Africa's First World War, as it's often been called, both by being in the West in Congo's capital, Kinshasa, but also regularly crossing the front line into eastern Congo, which was rebel-controlled for many years.
Just trying to think, has there ever been a time in the history of this sad country where things went well, when things were happy?
You know, it's interesting to talk to Congolese people about that, because these days, as they're either still living in zones of conflict or are only just coming out of conflict, many Congolese people actually look back to the days of Mobutu Sese Seko, who was Congo's kleptocratic dictator that ruled from the 1960s up until 1996. And while in the outside world, we, of course, especially near the end of this dictator's reign, saw him very much as one of the most corrupt leaders in Africa. In the 60s and 70s, this was a dictator who did bring a certain degree of peace and a degree of education to its people. Mm. So people do look back on those days
as of a golden era, heavens above. Now, I said in the intro that that declaration of peace was made in 2003. Did the transitional government stabilise things?
To a certain extent, a little bit, but not enough to really bring peace to the country. And eastern parts of Congo have remained incredibly volatile despite the transitional government, despite the peace agreement, despite elections. And it is that ongoing volatility and conflict that continues to result in horrific human rights abuses and widespread sexual violence for the women and girls of eastern Congo.
Who lost out from the peace deal? Which groups were the big losers?
Well, there were a number of big losers, but I guess the biggest one was one of the rebel groups that had been backed by the neighboring country of Rwanda, a rebel group many of whose leaders were Tutsi, which is one of the main ethnic groups in Rwanda. And they were, in the electoral process that followed the transitional government, one of the main losers. And they were the ones who continued to carry on with the conflict and continued to turn to weapons and armed conflict in order to gain political power.
Now, there are still 20,000 UN troops in the Congo, which has to be amongst the biggest peacekeeping forces operating today. But you reckon there's not enough? How many would be enough?
It is the biggest peacekeeping mission in the world, but when it was first created back in the days when Kofi Annan was Secretary General of the UN, in fact, there were requests for double that number and at times triple that number. But it wasn't what the UN Security Council and the richer nations of the world were prepared to authorize. So Congo has always scraped, in many ways, the bottom of the barrel.
But we're talking an immense area, aren't we? Because yeah, it's the size of Europe.
Indeed, the size of Western Europe, yes. This is a huge country, and the peacekeepers are incredibly thinly spread out. You know, it has nowhere near the peacekeepers per number of the population as Sierra Leone did, or even former Yugoslavia. You know, this is these are peacekeepers thinly spread on the ground.
Unoka, where do they come from, the UN troops? What's their makeup?
The vast majority of the peacekeepers are Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Nepalese, and Uruguayans.
Does that work?
It certainly has its problems. I mean, one of the main problems is that while these are countries that, of course, are great supporters of the United Nations, they don't come with necessarily the best equipped troops. Mm. So what we often find is while the richer nations sit on the UN Security Council and authorize these mandates, strong mandates to protect civilians, they're not willing themselves to send troops to places like Congo. And so what we find are troops that don't have the helicopter capability, that don't have the kind of mobility and resources that the richer nations of the world are able to provide if they were willing to send peacekeepers.
A couple of years ago, I interviewed the boss of the UN troops in Rwanda, who was driven to the edge of insanity and perhaps even a little bit beyond by his experiences there. I understand the troops in the Congo now have a mandate to fire when civilians are at risk.
Yes, and that is the big lesson learned from Rwanda, is now indeed the UN Security Council, in most of its more recent mandates that it gives UN peacekeepers, has authorized the use of force. But, you know, we have to take it a step further than that, because while on paper that is the right step to take, if we don't ensure that peacekeepers have the means to carry out that mandate, we're still going to run into some of those immense complexities that General Romeo Dallaire, the general you were referring to, who had been in Rwanda and who indeed, whose experiences marked not only him personally, but the UN. You know, we have moved a step forward, but my goodness, we need to move a few steps more to ensure that indeed peacekeepers can carry out their task.
We're not playing an appropriate role, are we? I'm talking about Australia or the US.
No, Australia is not, the US is not, the richer nations in Europe are not. Australia has been, of course, good in providing peacekeepers to places like East Timor, but in Africa, Australia and certainly Australian peacekeepers are largely non-existent.
Now, let's talk about the massacre which happened late last year, because that's the most dramatic illustration of the problems you're currently facing. No media reports of the violence for months, but to be fair, even for you in the Congo, it was hard to get more than vague details.
Yes, and I, you know, it breaks my heart that, that this is a reality often in places in Congo. But the area where this massacre took place was incredibly remote, but it had no telephones and no way for people to come out quickly with the information about what had happened. So the information trickled out slowly. And when myself and a colleague arrived in a nearby town nearly 2 months later, we were the first to start documenting the killing of over 300 people, men, women, children, who died in the most horrific way by having their skulls smashed in by axes, machetes, or heavy wooden clubs.
Yeah. Well, that's very Rwandan, isn't it, the way that was? And you had to go around and find the graves and get testimony from everyone you could.
I mean, I spoke to dozens and dozens of people who came to see me desperate that the information about what had happened to their loved ones and to their neighbors could be registered, could be known, could be documented. And, you know, from early in the morning to late at night, myself and a colleague spent days and days collecting testimonies, verifying what had happened, double-checking to make sure we had our facts straight, and indeed then going to some of the areas, some of the actual villages where this had happened, in order to be able to tell the story about what had gone on.
How do you cope?
Well, I've worked in Congo for more than 11 years now, and, you know, these stories are far too common, I'm afraid. But they do haunt me. You know, there are some stories more than others that rattle around in my head, that I think about often. But I'm a firm believer that we as individuals can affect change, and that while I document the worst things that human beings do to each other, I also have the privilege in my job to work with the real heroes, those human rights defenders in Congo, who call me up to say that a massacre has happened, who themselves will help whoever they can help and to document whatever they can document about what goes on. You know, I can go in and take the testimonies and name the perpetrators who did it, but I can also leave, right? I can get on a plane and go home. The people who live through this day in, day out can't. And I believe that, you know, by us standing shoulder to shoulder with such individuals, we can affect change and let the world know about what has happened.
Naked, let's tell the listener a little bit about the Lord's Resistance Army. I think they'd be interested to know why the name.
Yes, it is a bit of a strange name for a group that carries out such atrocities. Its leader, Joseph Kony, very much believes that the spirits have come down and given him instructions to start up a new tribe in Africa based on the Ten Commandments. And so the army was named the Lord's Resistance Army.
Excluding thou shalt not kill, clearly.
Well, I think one does have to ask the question whether Joseph Kony has actually read the Ten Commandments. But clearly this is a group that has gone well beyond those initial days where it might have felt it was doing the Lord's work, and has become a brutal, predatory group that bases itself on sheer fear and immense terror.
Looking at it through a secular prism, does anyone understand what the Lord's Resistance Army, Kony and his crew, are actually after, apart from this extraordinary notion of a Ten Commandments-based society?
You know, in the early days, their objective was to overthrow the government of Uganda, but it is clear that that is an objective that has disappeared over its 23-year history, where really this is a group that has become most well-known for its sheer brutality and, of course, for its abduction of children and turning children into combatants. I think this is now largely a group that is there for the survival of Joseph Kony, the leader of the group, and his cohorts. It is not for territory. It is not for any political ideology. This is a predatory bandit group.
From time to time, we've discussed the appropriateness of forcing warlords or others before international courts and charging them with war crimes. It seems to me that that's a very sharp two-edged sword. How do you feel about the fact that some warlords now face charges in the international court?
Well, it's clear in this particular case that I think there's general agreement that indeed Joseph Kony should be arrested and held to account for the horrific crimes he's committed. You know, I don't see anyone, including African countries or even those in Uganda, really supporting what this group has done and continues to do. And the International Criminal Court have carried out investigations on the crimes committed by the Lord's Resistance Army, and there are currently 3 arrest warrants for its top leaders. But in order to now carry out those arrest warrants, we need countries who are supporters of the International Criminal Court, of which Australia is one, to step up to the plate and to help bring about the arrest of these individuals. And boy, that's been tough, right? There are many countries who support the International Criminal Court, but who are not ready to really ensure that those arrest warrants are acted upon. And we need more support in that sense.
I should point out to the listener that when Human Rights Watch reports on these things, the government is just as likely to say that it's all fiction.
Yes, as they did in this particular case. So, you know, the Congolese government didn't want to accept initially that this had happened because it didn't fit in to their public relations game that everything was well in northern Congo and that the Lord's Resistance Army had largely been dealt with. When we documented and made public this massacre, this did not fit into their image that they'd been trying to portray that all was well. I mean, they have now, many in the government have now accepted indeed that this massacre did take place. But in the early days after we published the report, they were not too happy with Human Rights Watch and with the information we'd put out.
And of course, we're talking on pretty much on the eve of the 50th anniversary of independence.
Coming up on the month of June, that's right, Congo will celebrate this its Independence Day ceremony. And for that, President Joseph Kabila, the president of Congo, has wanted to portray an image that his country is at peace, that there is no more conflict. Of course.
So he's asking for the UN to withdraw the troops.
And he's wanting to show that all is well, yes. But that, of course, is not the story in northern Congo where the Lord's Resistance Army operates, nor is that the story in eastern Congo. And when we at Human Rights Watch, of course, start to unravel this picture and pull the veil away from what the government is attempting to hide, we get some tough reactions from the government.
Have you ever dealt with the president himself?
Indeed, I see the president relatively regularly, I would say. Myself, along with some of my colleagues, met with President Joseph Kabila about 8 months ago and spoke to him about our concerns on ongoing human rights abuses and raised a number of very specific cases with him. So, I mean, his door has remained open to us, which has been interesting.
What do you make of his curious response?
Well, the response has largely been from members of his government, but I believe that they had hoped to hide the fact that these kinds of atrocities were taking place because it was an inconvenient truth.
Yeah.
And we put them face to face with the truth, and they've, of course, had to backtrack.
Well, you know, I sit in a radio studio in Sydney, a long, long way away from these terrible places, but I remember one of the stories we talked about was the massive use of rape as a weapon of war, and it was just sort of gut-wrenching and totally heartbreaking. And you've estimated that 200,000 women have been raped during the course of this war.
Well, it's actually an estimate from the United Nations that more than 200,000 since 1998, of which the vast majority are adolescent girls between the ages of 12 and 17. And we are now documenting that the vast majority of the rapes are gang rapes, where perhaps 7 soldiers or armed combatants will rape 1 girl or 1 woman. It is
and do so publicly.
And often do so publicly and repeatedly. And it is one of the most heartbreaking effects of this war is the immense toll on the women and girls of Eastern Congo, where rape has become a weapon of war, where it is used to punish communities, to punish families for their perceived support to an enemy group, or in order to show who is in charge and who is in control. And it really is gut-wrenching and just so horrific, as one can imagine, in terms of its impact on families and communities.
But there's a hint of something good coming out of this, in that you talk about women becoming organized and actually talking publicly about rape for the first time.
Well, women haven't had much choice, of course. When the rapes have occurred as publicly as they have, it's very hard to hide that it happened. But indeed, we are now seeing, you know, what is an extraordinary beginning of a women's movement, where women are marching in the streets, where women are organizing, and where initially, this of course was around a single issue of rape, but where they're now saying, no, if we want to change this, we need women in political positions and in positions of authority. And we're seeing, out of something so horrible, something extraordinary happen.
Thank you very, very much for speaking with us. And I must say that banking's loss has been humanity's gain. Anna Kay, a privilege to talk to you.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was the splendid Annika von Woudenberg, Senior African Researcher with Human Rights Watch, and this is LNL on ABC Radio National, coming up, the politics of ideas in Australia.